I hope that you can hear me. Comment said that sometimes it's a little, so maybe I need to hold it a little more. I've got to find the sweet spot. Okay. Is this okay? So I want to start with a little story, and I want to embellish it a little bit. I want you to think of it as a Clint Eastwood movie. It's the kind of thing he would do. It's a little old Japanese town, and it's someplace in the distant, distant past. Kind of dusty. But interestingly, a Japanese village where people rode horses. So there they are in the village, kind of hanging out, wondering what to do, kicking a can down the road. And in the far distance comes a man on a horse, traveling towards town. And they watch him. It's probably kind of like a late Saturday afternoon, and they've had a little sake. So they watch this man approaching town, and as he gets closer, questions begin to enter their minds. Who is he? We've never seen him before. Is he going to make trouble for us? And as he approaches closer and closer, he finally gets to the center of this little group that has formed, and he stops his horse and looks at everybody, and people look at him and don't know what to say, don't know what to expect. So they ask him the most obvious question, "Hey, old man, where are you going?" And he responds, "If you want an answer to that question, you better ask my horse." So I thought I would begin with that story because this being a time of renewal, we want to look more deeply at how it is that we go where we are going. What is this horse? And why do we need to ask the horse instead of the rider? So it's very interesting as we gather here every Tuesday evening. We all come from our various places. We all put aside everything that happened in the day, although it's still swirling around in our minds. And then there's the agitation of having to get here. Car, taxi, bike, walk. And the cold air and the sounds in the streets, and then gathering as you enter the outside door and then the inside door, and then there's a little bit of a flurry, having to take off shoes, get your cushions, decide what chair to sit in, and finally the bell rings, you know. And something, the hustle and the bustle and the agitation gets a little muffled, but it's still there. You can feel it in the room. You can feel it in your body. And certainly the mind is still going. But if you give yourselves a little time, I can feel it in the room as the 40 minutes that we sit progress. There is this kind of unification. There is this sense of like coming down, going inside. It's like the big inflated balloon with all the many colors and all the many thoughts and all the many tales, begins to deflate. And we find ourselves just being in our body. And there are times when I feel little flurries of agitation. They seem to go through the group. And I think these are times when, oh, the body came awake again, the mind got active again, and then we slowly allow it to just calm down again. And then all of a sudden, we are both the horse and the rider. So what does it mean to be a rider that needs to ask the horse where they are going? Our minds, our bodies seem to control what it is that happens to us, how we feel about ourselves from moment to moment, what the decisions are that we make in any situation. Or you could say the horse is, you know, ask my wife. Don't ask the horse, ask my boss. Don't ask the horse, ask my parents who made me. Or it depends on, you know, how much money I made today. It depends on what I got for Christmas. It depends on whether she smiled at me or not. Whether he will marry me or not. So in a way, we are constantly being driven from one place to another, internally as well as externally, by all the conditions that arise. And you know, they're very strong, and you know, they're really, really numerous and very difficult to manage and contain. So the reason that we come into this, I'm assuming, what brings us all here to this practice, in spite of the fact that we have to confront the solidity of the body, the agitation of the mind, is that we really do long for that sense of being able to determine how it is that we feel from moment to moment and where it is that we go with our body, with our intention, with our hearts. The other thing that this story brings up for me in relation to renewal is the constantly arising question in every spiritual tradition, in every century, the bottom line question, who am I? Am I the horse? Am I the rider? Am I the pain in my knees when I try to sit? Am I the feelings that I have? Am I the breaths that I take? Who am I? We can't really renew ourselves by just putting on new polish on the old frame. We really have to get back to the germ, to the little initial cell, and even before that cell, that we are, that we grew from. How are we going to get there? How can we do that in a way that we can be completely assured, completely confident that we have landed in that place that we absolutely know is home? So that we can reflower, speaking of flowers, for the next year in a way that allows the direction of our thoughts and our intentions to be informed by something deeper than the wife, the boss, the income, and all the things that rattle around in our brains and drive us from moment to moment, and even when we're asleep, show up in our dreams. That horse. And when we get to that little kernel that is the origin of who it is that we are and are becoming, is that who we are? So I wanted to tell you a story about my experience of discovering or approaching the experience of who I might be. It happened on my first 10-day retreat long, long, long time ago when I was 24. I had done some meditation, but I had never done it over an extended period of time. I hadn't even done a weekend retreat. So I was teaching psychology in a university back in Connecticut. I had to take 10 days off. That was the first big thing. Do I? Don't I? What will they think? Will I lose my job? Oh my God, oh my God. But I made a decision and I made a commitment and left home, left the students, left my pets, left my friends, left the phone, and dedicated myself to 10 days of sitting in stillness and silence in January in Litchfield, Connecticut, when the snow was practically up to our knees. And because I was so terrified at what I had driven myself into, I listened to the description of how to practice very, very carefully and did it like to save my life. And one of the first things that I noticed was that I was leaning very, very heavily on my ankle and the front of this foot, and it was in agony about the third day. But another thing that started happening was my body started heating up. And even though I was eating like a pig, I was losing a pound a day, doing nothing. So something was going on in my physical system. And as the days proceeded and my mind grew quieter and quieter and I had no thoughts that I could hang on to or entertain myself with or that seemed really, really compelling and life-saving to resolve, my mind had finally gotten quiet the way they said it would. It does. I had only my bodily sensations. And so I was focusing on my hands that were vibrating. For some reason, I thought maybe it's because I was doing a lot of body work with people. So for about a day and a half, my object of awareness from 4:30 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night, when I wasn't eating or listening to Dharma talks, was the sensation of vibration in my hands. And because it was January and because it was Connecticut, it was overclouded most of the time. And you know, when you spend a lot of time with your eyes closed, you can sense the light in the room whether you're through your eyelids. So I'd always had this consistent sense of grayness. But at the 10 o'clock sitting on the fifth day, for some reason or another, the clouds dispersed and the sunlight filled the atmosphere in the room. And the moment that the sunlight hit my eyelids, the vibration in my hands simultaneously moved up my arms and came up my heart, and my body and my mind disappeared. And I remained in that space for some time. The only way that I can describe it is that nobody was home, but the lights were definitely on. And the atmosphere was infinite, spacious, and it did have this luminosity that they talk about. And I read about that afterwards, not before, so it wasn't a suggestion. It did have spangly golden silver dust that seemed very evenly distributed throughout. Not in a bling-bling way. And very subtle. And the feeling was sublime. And of course, at one point or another, a thought enters the mind, oh, wow, you know, or whatever it was. And at that very moment, the whole thing collapsed and I was back. The question is, which I was the real I? And if the spacious I is the real I, how is it possible that there was no me there? So who am I? Who are you? Fundamentally, is that really, really what you are here to explore and discover? If you think about it, all the clothes we wear, every single morning we wake up, we go to the closet, we think about, what am I going to wear? Partly it's because we want to protect ourselves from the weather. But mostly it's because we're putting on it some kind of an identity that is appropriate for what we're going to be doing during that day. So we think about the possibility of just taking off the clothes, taking off the things that we use between ourselves and the world, between ourselves and other people. And being naked in a sense, like Adam and Eve were naked in the Garden of Eden before they ate the apple of knowledge, of self-awareness, of thinking. When all of a sudden they felt naked and they covered up, right? All of a sudden there was vulnerability. All of a sudden there was shame. All of a sudden there was somebody to cover up. So maybe renewal is the possibility of being able to get back to that elemental freedom, that ephemeral, light, undefined place that we sometimes touch when we meditate. I know that you all do it. That place where the body all of a sudden feels light and almost disappears. The mind gets quiet and buoyant. And all of a sudden, everything that we've been so concerned about, so passionately, just melts away. And there might even be a deep inner wonder, why was it all so compelling? What was the big deal? That's the horse, all that stuff. And it hardly ever leaves us alone. And we hardly ever feel that we can get off the horse. Let all those very, very, very compelling things melt away for just a moment, or maybe a day. What do we stand to lose? What do we stand to gain? Refreshment. Buoyancy, open mind, gentle heart, trust, fearlessness. You could say it's like being like a child again, but it's actually being the real adult. So being able to always return to that question, who am I? Is a way of always inviting renewal. We can do it with every breath. Every breath can be a portal that liberates us into that expansion, that spaciousness, that experience that we're not home, but all the light is on. So listening to that suggestion, I wonder, is it terrifying? Is it a kind of a clutching sense of loss? Are we fearful that we'll be incompetent? We won't be able to manage our lives? Won't be able to accomplish the things that we want to? If we're not driven? What about the possibility of just being home in this very moment? In that silence, is there anybody home? There is sensing, there is breathing, there is hearing, possibly listening. Is that enough? Do we always have to have more? Isn't this the very place that we want to experience when we reach out for all those things that we think we have to perform for? Is it all for the purpose of arriving at this simple, peaceful place? So how long can we tolerate this peacefulness before we have to get agitated again? That's the real question. Because I'm always astounded at how quickly we run away. And what do we run away to? We run away into the chaos and the twists and turns, the winds, the storms. And in the midst of them, we struggle. We try to figure it out, use all of our resources to get back to this place. So somebody very generously copied some Hafiz poems for me, and in one of the translations there's just two lines that I'm going to try to read without my glasses. So, Hafiz, if your desire, if you desire the presence from him, then be not absent. If thou desires the presence from him, be not absent. Think of him as the presence, period. This is from the Sufi tradition where there is a sense that there is a beloved, which is a way of dropping deeply into one's heart and being in a state of being in love. And the object of love is whatever you want to be close to. If you want that closeness, then you have to be present. If you want that feeling of resonance, that feeling of fullness, that feeling of fulfillment, it really is right here. Very, very close, as all the wise people say. As close as the breath, and even closer. So maybe part of our practice is to expand our capacity to be able to dwell in this peacefulness. Our minds want to make some trouble or to worry about something or to question something. But really, the whole point is we can always come back. to just being quiet. And present. And fundamentally okay. So we have a few minutes, and I would love to hear some questions, some comments, some wisdom from you. You all have a lot of wisdom, I know it. Share it. Or maybe you would just like to stay in. Yes. No? Yes. I know. I know. Can you imagine? People always say, "Oh my God, you were so young, and oh, how wonderful!" But no, I never had it again. So lots and lots and lots of my practice had to do with letting go. But I have to tell you that I feel it all the time. I do feel it as a foundation that my practice takes me to. And I, one of the things that happened as a result of that, I realized when I went that afternoon to have my Dharma talk, and I told my teacher what happened, and he was impressed, but not that impressed. But the thing that he said was, to carry on, you know. It's not like there's going to be peaks and valleys, and the peaks, you know, you just carry on. That's just the idea. But I told him that I had lost my fear of death, and through that experience, and because I genuinely felt that I, as Yvonne, did not need to be around for awareness to exist. I had that experience, and I was very grateful for it. And I know now that I'm much closer to the actual experience of death, that it still holds on, that I still feel fearless about it because of that. And it solidified my intention, and I took a vow that I would make myself available at any time when people wanted to be taught, so that everybody had the opportunity to experience some aspect of being liberated from fear, whatever fears might be dwelling in any of us at any time through this practice. Because fear is one of the great things that gets released very easily when we practice. Melting the experience of self is a little trickier, but it happens too. And it can happen gradually. You know, you can chisel it down. And I'm sure that you understand, and that's what's been happening. Yeah. It doesn't always seem like fear is that easy to get rid of. Yeah. It wasn't that easy. I had done a lot of... I mean, those 5 days were really intense because I had really taken a plunge. And... but it only takes one experience. It only takes one moment to eradicate things that feel so solid and so... intransient, you know? That's interesting, isn't it? And I think that that's the experience that I have every time that I sit. I come in like you with things, thoughts, agitation. What am I going to say, you know? And conversations, things to resolve, all that kind of stuff that seems to go on in all of our minds. And I do feel it drop away. So, you know, when I come in, it feels very real, very solid, something to grapple with. About 10, 15, 20 minutes into sitting, it has dissolved. What was the big deal? And so that's really the fundamental gift of practice, is it puts things in perspective when we really need perspective. It really does open the door to what's real, as opposed to what's always driving us. And that is the only liberation we can hope for. Liberation from persistent seemingly intractable delusions. Yeah.
So most of us are driven around by the things that drive us the worst, that pushes us in this direction or that direction, because we have to live, do stuff. But when suddenly many of those obligations and those things aren't driving you anymore, and your basic things taken care of, and you can just sit, how are you supposed to figure out where to go or how to go if the worst is no longer there?
I'm so sorry you have so little confidence. Yeah. So the question is, when we have things taken care of enough that our agitations really do seem inconsequential and they do calm down, and the horse is no longer driving us, how do we know what to do then? So, and my response was, I'm so sorry that you have so little confidence. Because really, there's no doing at that point. It's just being. But that doesn't mean that you're ineffective or passive or inactive. It means that you actually are mobilized from a place that is in the bodhicitta, in the mind heart of the person that is calm, rather than the person that is driven. Doesn't mean that we don't act in the world. It doesn't mean we don't take care of things, including ourselves, our well-being, our livelihood, the people we love. It just means that it is the motivation and the action arises from a different place. It is not externally driven. It is not riled up through all of the tension of being conditioned. Have you never experienced yourself just doing things in a calm way and managing to do everything just right? Yeah. It's not like I'm talking about experiences that are far away from us. We've all tasted these things. And one of the reasons of practice is to kind of like, you know, bring that, you know, allow ourselves to get more and more and more trust and confidence and get rooted in the sensation of having actions arise from a place where we don't necessarily, you know, we don't really know where that comes from. It just happens and it's the right action. And we can look back at it and say, wow. We can do that more and more, be more consistent with that. There is a way of being a competent, alive, fully present person that is appropriate without being driven. Yeah. What would the horse say? The horse would say, I'm an animal. I'm not very self-aware. I'm just controlled by causes and conditions. I'm out of control. What do you think the horse would say? Okay. You know, this position is called the king's position. It is called the royal pose. In part, it's because in the yoga series, it's the last position because you can hold it the longest. So it's the one that is seen as the quickest road to wisdom, insight, liberation. But the other of it is that it has a natural nobility. You can feel it when you're in the posture. You can feel that your back, you know, your spine just begins to naturally line up. Your breathing seems to normalize itself. The body seems to know what it needs to do, the little micro adjustments that put it back into balance. And the feeling is that the spine is stretching and there is a sensation of regency. You know. So there is a sense of what they use the word mastery a lot. There is a sense of mastery. You're not doing anything. You're probably not thinking anything. And yet there is this, you know, this elegant mastery, stretched out, relaxed, but alert state in mind, heart, and body, and unified. So there is a sense that at that very moment, at this very moment, we are captain of the ship, a sense of well-being. A sense that we are close to the answer. Who am I? This is who we are. Everything else is icing on the cake. And every time I do notice the expanse of years from my first retreat to now, that every time that I touch into this place, it feels familiar. It's like I've been here before. I know you have that feeling. Ah, here I am again. I've been far away, but here I am. I've returned. So is that who I am? So, for the new year, my wish for you is to return to this space as often as you can. Answer that question for yourselves. Remember that you have touched into this space and it doesn't go away. It just gets covered over. It's 9:00. Beep, beep. So thank you very much.
So In the spirit of generosity, the teachings here are freely offered, and so we invite you to share your generosity with Teacher Donna in the Donna Basket. Also, as a reminder, we have a $150 a week room rental that we have to pay, so room rental Donna is also, you can also be left in the Donna Basket. Happy New Year to everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.